from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support for the legislature today is provided by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Learn more at aarp.org/WV. The Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Lumos Networks, online at lumosnetworks.com. Marshall University, with more than 100 degree programs offered in 4 locations and online. More about the Marshall family at marshall.edu. Orion Strategies, professional public relations, government affairs, creative services, and research and polling, with offices in Charleston, Buchanan, Martinsburg, Pittsburgh, and Columbus.
Good evening and welcome to the legislature today. Investigation continues into Saturday's horrific fire in Clay County, which claimed the lives of 4 foster children. It's put an intense and more immediate spotlight on a child welfare system in crisis. Lawmakers have been working throughout interim sessions on addressing the significant needs of the state's foster care system. We'll have that discussion in just a few minutes. But first, Assistant News Director Glynis Board starts our focus with this report.
Amanda McCreary is a social service coordinator at the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources in Wheeling. She's among the state employees on the front lines of the foster care crisis in the Northern Panhandle.
There's a whole bunch of older children who just want a loving family. A lot of teens, preteens, they just want a forever family. And it's heartbreaking to listen to them call their social worker and their social worker answer the phone and say, no, I haven't found you that family yet, but I'm still looking. They want to know. They want somebody to want them.
According to the DHHR, West Virginia is the number one state in the country for children removed from their homes. 85% of those child protective services cases involved drugs. As of September 2018, almost 7,000 West Virginia children are in foster care. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. The DHHR estimates that in order to really take care of our kids right now, we need more psychiatrists, school nurses, social workers, healthcare facilities, and all that's estimated to cost the state more than $150 million.
There's just not enough people out there. We're overwhelmed. The whole opioid epidemic, the need for foster placements has just spiraled. You need more workers, you need more staff, there are more cases, there are more families being affected by this. We need more resources. So initially it's a huge complex issue that's going to require a lot of money that West Virginia as a state probably doesn't have.
Foster parents today are desperately needed, but with such a strained state system, parents have to be prepared for what they're getting into. David Johnson is a United Methodist pastor. He and his wife are foster parents in Southern West Virginia. He says kids are coming into the system with a lot of trauma.
And that's a lot to deal with as foster parents, and to try to help kids walk through that at the same time navigating a really overburdened system is difficult. Because in addition to just the daily struggles of being a parent, which are hard to begin with, then you add behaviors born of trauma on top of that, and then having to get them to eye doctor, dentist, doctor, therapists, possibly visits with their biological parents, getting to court, multidisciplinary team meetings. I mean, the amount of time it takes, in addition to just the time it takes to be a parent, can be difficult.
Johnston says foster parents need support from their communities and workplace flexibility in order to properly be present for their kids.
Getting out of our silos, I think, is important to doing this work. That it's going to take a coordinated effort between child services, between law enforcement, the courts, churches and other religious communities and everyday people. I think trying to reach out to employers as part of this to help them understand a role they can play both in giving people in recovery jobs as well as being compassionate towards workers who are dealing with kids in foster care or kids who are navigating behavioral difficulties born of trauma.
Experts across disciplines, healthcare, schools, court, all agree that the landscape of their workplaces has changed drastically in the last 20 years. People throughout the region who work with children all report increases of traumatizing childhood experiences, which could have devastating impacts on the health and well-being of these kids, as well as the future of the state.
We've got to find a way to put them on a different path in life. And if we do not do that, they're going to repeat history. It's going to be generational.
Jessica Watt is a school counselor at Madison Elementary in Ohio County. She was at a roundtable series focused on the state's child welfare crisis this fall. Watt spoke about the new normal she's experiencing at her elementary school, where children are routinely recounting violent acts at home as if they are ordinary occurrences. Madison Elementary has since embraced trauma-informed practices, where teachers and staff have all learned to recognize and respond to traumatized children. And all school employees work together to try to provide a consistent, safe, and compassionate environment.
This, to me, is more, it's life or death for these children. And so if we don't start addressing these kinds of things, we're not going to have any little people left to teach to read and write anymore. So to me, it's more important than that. And I'm fortunate to be in a building where I have a principal who gets that.
Healthcare practitioners and mental health experts from across the state are calling not just for schools, but workplaces, hospitals, recreational spaces, all institutions in the state to become trauma-informed. And this is an idea that's actually starting to take off in some places in the state. For the Legislature Today, I'm Glynis Board.
Joining us now are House Majority Leader and member of the House Health and Human Resources Committee, Delegate Amy Summers, and Jeremiah Samples, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you both so much for being here. Mr. Samples, I think I'm going to start with you because of the numbers. More than 6,000 children have been removed from their homes, the highest in the country, and a staggering number of Child Protective Services referrals. 28,000 and 18,000 are accepted. Just tell us broadly the ravages of the opioid epidemic, the drug epidemic, in terms of the child welfare.
Well, thank you for having me here today. The situation is actually even worse than what you outlined. We have over 7,200 children in state custody. That's a 67% increase since 2013. Most of this is driven by the drug crisis. Approximately 85% of all abuse neglect cases have drug use in the home. And over 50%, about 53% of all children removed from the home, substance abuse is the number one reason for that, or the primary reason for that.
And let me ask Delegate Summers, before we get into specific things that you're looking at here at the legislature, you are a registered nurse, and can you talk briefly about what trauma exposure how this puts them on a road to these children? They're at risk for any number of conditions and health and emotional concerns.
Yes, they are. And in the emergency department where I work, and also in past experiences I've had as a medical examiner, we see these things playing out in society that are so sad for our children. The most vulnerable people in our population that we have to take care of. And that's what we're trying to do here in the legislature, is what things can we do to enhance the foster care system, to get more people to be involved in that system, and continue to make it safe. And that's what we're looking at this week in a foster care bill.
And just broadly, what What are those components? What do you hope to get out in a bill?
Many of us have held foster care forums in our hometowns, and we've been listening to different people that participate, the foster care parents, the DHHR, the CPS workers, part of the DHHR. What can we do to make it easier but still safe for people to be foster parents? Because we need more parents. We need everybody in West Virginia to step up and help these kids because we're in an absolute crisis.
Mr. Samples, the secretary has come before the legislature saying to hire and place the needed mental health workers in our school system would take $100 million. What do you think is realistic? What are you asking this legislature for?
The Justice Administration has invested more in child welfare than any administration in state history. And just to give context to those numbers, in 2017, we had approximately $243 million in expenditure for child welfare. In 2020, the coming fiscal year, we anticipate $350 million in expenditures. And so the governor has invested the state's resources, and we have worked very closely with the legislature, the judicial branch, and several stakeholders to really tackle this issue from a number of different angles. To build off what the majority leader had stated, this is going to take every West Virginian. It's not a DHHR crisis. It's not a crisis of one community or another. This is a state crisis, and our most valuable resource, our children, they're suffering traumas that really, folks, I think it's hard for people to comprehend.
Are you getting an additional appropriation to hire more mental health workers in your schools, in our schools?
We have put in funding to expand, a funding request to the legislature to expand crisis services for children, to expand school-based health services, also to expand wraparound services. It's not enough to react to a crisis after it's happened. We need to be able to get upstream and try to save these families, the families that can be saved, so that these children never have to be removed from the home in the first place.
And additional staffing, we heard that in the piece that just aired. There's just not enough people to provide the services.
This past year, DHHR did add an additional 50 child protective service workers across the state. We also increased salaries in conjunction with the legislature for CPS workers. On top of the governor's 5% last year for state employees, we added 2%. And in this year's budget, we have added, on top of the governor's 5%, an additional 3%. And so we are looking at various strategies to increase the workforce, but also to ensure that these folks that are really serving the most vulnerable people in society are adequately and appropriately compensated.
Delegate Summers, more foster parents are needed, more foster families are needed. How are you approaching that? We've heard that some regulations will be loosened, and then that throws up some concern too. Are there regulations that can be tweaked?
Absolutely, and that's what we've been looking at. How can we reduce bureaucracy like paperwork, but still keep the home safe and keep the children safe? So how can we achieve that? So we've been meeting with a lot of different stakeholders to find that balance, because there will be people that are interested in being foster parents, and by the time they go through months and months of paperwork, the process is cumbersome. So how can we streamline it but keep it safe? What can we do to make it easier? And also, we just need people to understand the need. Like, we need people to help our kids.
Mr. Samples, when a child is taken from the home, what happens first? The preference is to get a relative to take that child in, is it not?
That's correct. And there's a multitude of scenarios depending on the child's need. If the child has a medical need, then certainly that has to be the first priority to be addressed. Sadly, a lot of these children face a number of different traumas, and so they may have behavioral health issues or psychiatric issues that may also need to be addressed. But in a typical case, the first step is to try to find a kinship placement, a relative that can watch after the child. And if a kinship placement is not available, then we certainly look for foster families to take the child in.
And sometimes DHHR staff folks are in hotels for a week or two until a placement is found. I mean, they're in hotels with these children that need placed.
Sadly, over the past few years, you know, just given the volume, the increase in the number of children that have to be taken into state custody, just given unsafe conditions that they face, we have had incidents where DHHR workers have had to stay either in DHHR offices or in hotel rooms with children while we search for placement. We have did a good job in increasing the number of foster families available in the state. We work with private sector companies to find and to facilitate those placements. But unfortunately, the volumes that we're talking about have just been overwhelming to some degree. And that's, again, to the point we have to get upstream. Even a child that's removed from a home that the parent has been abusive or neglectful, that child still loves their parents. And to be able to save those families that can be saved will both mitigate the stresses on the system, but also minimize any traumas that those children face.
And Delegate Summers, in just about a minute that we have left, we know that DHHR is considering a more of a care management program for the children that they are responsible for. Tell us briefly what that is and how the legislature is receiving that. Your thoughts on that kind of program?
We're talking about a managed care health model in the bill that we're proposing, because we need continuity of care for these children. They might be in one family in one county, move to another family in another county. We can't let their medical care fall through the cracks because we don't know what this doctor did or that doctor did. The managed care model allows for one group to be managing those children so that we don't have any lapses in care.
All right, and we'll be following that bill. We thank both of you for being here, House Majority Leader Amy Summers and Jeremiah Samples of DHHR. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
All of its children had come to the Mother Church of Country Music. It was almost like a badge of honored that you had to bring your culture with you to the table. That's why Bob Wills and his guys brought us Western music. That's why Hank Williams brought the South with him from honky tonks. Johnny Cash brought the black lamb dirt of Arkansas. Bill Monroe brought music out of Kentucky bluegrass music. Willie Nelson brought his poetry from Texas. Patsy Cline brought her heartache from Virginia. I mean, it was the most wonderful parade of sons and daughters of America that brought their hearts and their souls and their experiences, and it gave us a great era in country music.
And welcome back to the Legislature Today. I'm Suzanne Higgins, and senior State House reporter Dave Mistich joins us now. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is the first full Monday of the legislative session. We had last week some organizational kinds of procedures and swearing-ins. What's happening this week?
Right, so the committees are taking up bills. A lot of these are carryover bills from last session. There have been a handful of bills, both in the House and Senate, that cleared first reading today. So typical process, as we see every year. I think the wheels are just getting turning. It seems slow now, but things are bound to get more exciting, you know, as things move along.
Now, we know that there are some bills that are making a second appearance that didn't get through last year. What are those?
That's right. So we've heard a lot about the free community and technical colleges, the free tuition for that program. Both the governor and Republican leadership have championed that, particularly over here in the Senate. We're also hearing about intermediate courts that was brought up in the State of the State address. the business inventory tax repeal, hearing a lot of different numbers about how much that might bring in, how it would work. The mechanism to fund public schools is the big question on that. So we're waiting to see the finance chairs, how they work out that issue. But overall, you know, things that were big last year are coming back this year.
Both sides, both parties are in support of a Social Security tax exemption, and that bill was introduced today.
Right. So we had a version of that bill that was introduced in the House that was from Delegate Pat McGeehan and Delegate John Schott. We're likely to see that bill come from, you know, the request of the executive, the governor's office. Likely to see other versions of that bill in the House and probably a version in the Senate as well. So we do have one version already, though, so.
A joint resolution in the Senate also today. Now, that was really interesting.
Yeah, it is, especially given what happened over the latter part of 2018. Of course, the Supreme Court impeachments, the governor got to appoint three justices. Senate Joint Resolution 8, introduced today by Senator Rucker, I believe Senator Azinger was also a sponsor on that, would look to have the Senate confirm gubernatorial appointments for this. We all know that the Supreme Court is elected, but if there's a vacancy, the governor just gets to make that appointment until the next election rolls around, until they can have a special election. We saw that with the appointment of Congressman Evan Jenkins and former House Speaker Tim Armstead. So we'll see if that goes anywhere, but that conversation's still online here.
All right, and then for the rest of this week, we can expect budget hearing after budget hearing.
Right, we saw a few of those today over in the House. It was the Community and Technical College Program, the Higher Education Policy Commission. Over here in the Senate, we heard from the Attorney General's office. So each agency will outline their budget, say what their needs are, say how they spend their money, and we'll hear that from dozens upon dozens of folks over here over the next few weeks.
All right. Now, at this point, I'd like to invite our digital reporter, Shayla Klein, to join us. She joins us from the Morgantown station. And we've asked Shayla to follow the social media accounts of the governor, of lawmakers, different organizations and lobbying groups that will be very active here over the next 2 months, and to share with us what those folks are posting. So welcome, Shayla. What do you have to share with us tonight?
Hi, Suzanne. So the first tweet that we have for you today comes from Senator Greg Boso. He responded to a Charleston Gazette Mail reporter, Katie Coyne, who tweeted, "A follow-up to last month's During the Water series, West Virginia pays more water bills so that more than 300 water systems across the state can treat and pump billions of gallons of water to their faucets. The problem? Only 25% of that water even reaches customers." Then Senator Boso gives her a well done and says, "I have a bill that is being prepared that will be an additional assistance to small water systems, building bipartisan support before intro. As a civil engineer in the legislature, I understand how neglect has impacted rural water systems."
And they've been neglected for decades, really. And actually, we were part of the Report for America. And we'll be having some of those reporters on the set later in the session. We'll be following Senator Boso's bill. What else do you have, Shayla?
The second thing I have for you comes from a new grassroots movement called Not Us West Virginia. On Instagram, they're asking students to come to the Capitol to stand against drug abuse on Thursday at 9 a.m.
And that's a really neat effort. It was started by high schoolers and colleges, and we're expecting several of those groups here, several schools here on Thursday will be covering that. And it's really a mentoring kind of positive peer pressure approach that they're taking. So we'll be talking to them Thursday. What else do you have, Shayla?
Absolutely. And the final tweet comes from House Majority Whip Paul Espinoza, and he says, "It's about to get real. Hashtag let the whipping begin."
That's really, I haven't seen him with his whip. I've seen him around, but I haven't seen him with his whip.
Good old legislative humor.
We just have a minute. Dave, how about a quick preview of tomorrow's story?
Well, we've been hearing a lot about this medical cannabis fix. There's some Democrats in the House that are also trying to push recreational marijuana. So we'll see how that matches up. We've heard from the governor that he's adamantly and absolutely opposed. I think that's the direct quote from him on the recreational use for adults. But the medical fix is in the works, and we'll see how that goes. But I spoke to various lawmakers in both the House and Senate about both those issues, but just the marijuana industry as a whole, and their feelings on medical, recreational, and how that fits into the state budget.
Okay, and we'll be looking forward to that. That's tomorrow on the legislature today, as Dave mentioned, the West Virginia medical marijuana law and the issue of recreational marijuana use. Then joining us on set, the Senate President and the House Speaker. We're out of time this evening. I'm Suzanne Higgins. For everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you for joining us and have a great evening.